Hey there. Ever wonder what happens to all those amazing screenplays that never make it to the big screen? Wonder no more. Welcome to Table Read Podcast, where we bring those undiscovered gems to life. Picture this, talented actors giving incredible performances with the occasional laugh or blooper thrown in, produced by award-winning pros. From drama to comedy, TV pilots to feature films, there's something for everyone. And guess what? We release new episodes every week, so don't forget to hit that subscribe button. Table Read Podcast, where great stories finally get their chance to shine.
Welcome, everybody, to another episode of IGN Unfiltered, my monthly or so interview series where I have the privilege of sitting down with the best, brightest, most interesting minds in the games industry. And today, we're not going on the dev side, but rather on the media side with one of the more interesting characters in the world of games media, somebody whose name you probably know, someone whose name that certain game publishers probably fear. Jason Schreier, welcome.
Hello, it's good to be here, Ryan. Thank you so much for having me.
Absolutely.
I don't know about the best or brightest, but I'm certainly here. Hello.
Well, it's you've written a couple of books now. That's why you're not here for your health, even though it's nice to talk to you. Or you're out on the book promotion. We'll talk about the book. It's Press
this
Reset.
This is actually my first. This is the first stop of my book tour.
Oh, good. So all right. So you're not exhausted and tired of telling the same anecdotes yet. So I'll get the full, like, 100% version in this interview, which I'm grateful for.
You should expect nothing less. If I'm coming on IGN, if I'm talking to Ryan McCaffrey, you are getting 100% unfiltered, you might say.
I appreciate the sly plug. Well, let's do an obvious plug for you. You are here to promote your new book, your second book. It's called Press Reset, Ruin and Recovery in the Video Game Industry. And once again, you've said about just digging deep into a number of game studios and their just behind the scenes stories, which I've read the whole book before this interview. And it's, you know, there's some of the stories I was at least familiar with on some level, but you go way, way deeper into it. And of course, you're a reporter at Bloomberg. You arguably really made your name at Kotaku before coming over to Bloomberg, what, a year or two ago now. And this is what you do. You are really the preeminent proper investigative reporter in the games media business. Certainly not the only one, but you've certainly got a number of great stories on your resume. For me, I mean, I always like doing the superhero origin story on this show. I'd love to know like how people got to where they are. Particularly since, you know, you and I are colleagues, and it's like, I'm interviewing a colleague here. So I got to start. What was your first console or PC? Where did your video game life start?
Okay. So my first console was the NES, which my parents actually had before I was born. So I was born in 1987 and they had it. Or maybe they got it like before I was old, like when I was a baby. Because it came out, I think, around 87. So they had it before I was old enough to play it, is the point. And so they very quickly got me hooked on that when I was probably too young. Like these days you would say, no screen time for a two-year-old. But back then they didn't know any better. And they were like, sure, stick them in front of the NES. It's the only thing that gets this toddler to stop bogging us all the time. So I was really into the NES. I actually recently unearthed a box of my old NES games from my parents' place and found like my old copy of the first Final Fantasy and some Sesame Street game that I used to play and all sorts of other stuff. Terrible, terrible games amidst the NES days. So that was my first console. And then I also would play PC games also with my parents because they were into that stuff. And like my mom, because of her job, she was able to bring home free PC games. So we would play together and stuff like that.
So was it really both parents? Was it both of them that were gamers?
Yeah, well, they weren't. I wouldn't call them gamers. It was more that they were both very into technology, and so they were into the newest stuff, and like they kept up with like the internet and computers. And they were not your typical millennial parents who are just like need help logging into their Hotmail accounts or whatever. they were both internet savvy and computer savvy when I was growing up, and so they liked playing stuff with me and like sharing that with me, which was cool. It was very like the formative thing and one of the the paths that took me into a career that is covering the video games industry, I think was just growing up being immersed in games and playing them all the time.
But bringing home computer games as part of your job, I mean, that's pretty cool, but actively going out and buying a Nintendo Entertainment System, that's for when you don't even have a kid or your son's an infant, that's some like next level cool parent stuff right there.
Yeah, it was pretty cool. Yeah, I can't complain. Can't complain about my parents too much. they were cool when it came to games, and they were very much, they didn't like spoil me or anything, and like they weren't buying me every single game I wanted or anything, but they were very supportive of the hobby, as opposed to, I know I have a lot of friends, and even my wife weren't allowed consoles growing up, and my parents were very much on the opposite end, where they believed very much, and I share that belief in like all things in moderation, which I think is actually a really good kind of tool in life and in parenting. And it's something that I'm certainly gonna use for my kids, which is like, we're not gonna stop you from playing video games, but like you can only play a couple hours a day or something like that. Like where it's more, it's not letting you just eat yourself to death with candy, play video games all day until your eyes bleed, but also not going the opposite approach and being like, no consoles allowed here, which I think is pretty cool. I think that's like a good way to approach things in general, just like moderation.
Do you have a memory of what the first game was? I know you mentioned the Sesame Street game, you mentioned the old copy of Final Fantasy I, but do you remember what might have been like the first formative game memory you had?
Yeah, it was definitely the first Final Fantasy, and I remember I would just play the crap out of it, but I could never get past. Have you played the original Final Fantasy?
I never did. I've never been a big Final Fantasy guy myself.
Okay, you're not a JRPG nerd, but yeah, so you get up to, there's this part early in the game that people familiar with the game will know, and it's called the Marsh Cave, and it is essentially this like super difficult first dungeon of the game, and as a kid I had no idea how to get past this thing, and NES games were all super hard for various reasons, mostly because they were from the arcade lineage where it was like, we want games to be super hard so you keep paying quarters, and NES games kind of took that design mentality and brought it to consoles. With Final Fantasy, that first dungeon was so friggin' hard that as a kid, I'm 4 or 5 years old playing it, I can never get past it. And so I would just kind of read through the walkthrough and the instruction manuals and all that stuff and just like imagine that I was getting further. Eventually down the road when I was older, I would make more progress in the game. But at first, when I was 4 or 5, I was happy to just keep replaying the first parts of the game over and over again, which is so funny today. Like these days, I'm like, man, I don't have time for any of that. I don't have time for games that like, to have no respect for my time, that sort of thing. But back then, when you're a kid, you're just willing to just go through this monotony because you're just so amazed by the novelty of it all. And I think that's what the first Final Fantasy was like for me. And yeah, very formative.
Well, was Final Fantasy I like a big like motivator to get you to learn how to read so that you could follow along with all the text?
It was, yeah. I was pretty quick to start reading, and so that helped. But video games in general, I think, were pretty good at helping me read. I definitely remember, like, I have a lot of vocabulary that I learned from like early JRPGs on the Super Nintendo, like Final Fantasy games and stuff like that. Definitely learned a lot of things from Ted Woolsey, the infamous translator of a lot of SquareSoft RPGs back in the day. He taught me a lot of vocab. I will say that.
Thank you, Ted.
Thanks, Ted.
So let's fast forward. Like, so how do you end up doing this? At what point do you know that you want to write about video games and try to make video games a career in some way, shape, or form?
I never knew that. I still don't know that. I part of me is like, yeah, maybe I'll be a novelist one day. No, I always knew that I wanted to be a writer. I was always into writing things. I would like write little fan fiction when I was growing up of all these games I was playing, all the Final Fantasy games and stuff. And I always like since a very early age, I would just read voraciously and try to write all the time. I didn't really discover journalism until I was in high school when I was on my school paper, and then kind of carried that into college and did some other journalism stuff in college. And then what happened was, after I graduated from college, I went to NYU. After I graduated, I was still in the New York area. moved back in with my parents for a bit, and I was doing kind of freelancing, trying to figure out where my career was going to go. And I started doing freelancing for like local journalism outlets in the suburbs of New York. And I remember, this is my apocryphal story, which is I remember I was going to a local government meeting and covering it. And they were talking, it was like a zoning board meeting.
Right.
And they were talking about whether a fence should be allowed to be 25 feet or 30 feet. And they were arguing, like this board is arguing, should this fence be allowed to be here 25 feet, 30 feet? And it's all like these 67-year-old people who just have nothing else to do but argue over things. And I'm sitting there and I'm like, this is the most boring thing in the world. Like, I do not want to be doing this. Like, I love reporting, but I need to be writing about something more interesting. And then I happened to just kind of think, like, I wonder if it's feasible to write about video games for a living. And I had done like a little bit, like played around with like freelancing for volunteer websites and during college and writing reviews for them. But that was the point where I was just like, let me try and see what happens here. And then I started freelancing for a bunch of different websites and outlets, and eventually got a gig writing for Wired for Chris Kohler, who then became my colleague at Kotaku afterwards. But he was kind of the person who gave me my big break in the video game media world when he brought me aboard to Wired. And then from there, after a couple of years at Wired, wound up going to Kotaku and stayed at Kotaku for eight years and some change, and then went to Bloomberg last year. And that's the sum of it.
Well, so do you remember, you mentioned freelancing, you get your start on some unpaid stuff, but do you remember the first game story that you got paid for? Because I'll always remember mine, but I'm sort of curious if yours is in your head too.
Yeah, well, what's yours?
So I actually didn't get paid to do anything until I got to OXM. I did some free stuff. I don't know if you remember a website from the late 90s called The Adrenaline Vault, A-Vault. I did a couple reviews for them, you know, for free. That website was famous. Like the reviews, they were like 4,000 words. It was just, there was no, it was just like, let's just keep people on the website. And it was super long, but I reviewed.
Gotta get that engagement.
Yeah. Warcraft 3 of all things, like this major, major game. I guess nobody on staff, Pete Hines actually worked there way back in the day. Strange coincidence, but first one I ever got paid for was, would have been my first review at OXM, which was for a post-apocalyptic BMX game. You can find it in, I guess, around the December or holiday 2002 issue. A game called Toxic Grind, which no one will remember.
Toxic Grind.
Toxic Grind. Not a bad game. I gave it a 7-something, I think.
I wonder if the developers of that game, if like someone who worked on that game is watching this, and it's,
you never
like,
know.
Oh, wow,
it's a small
Toxic
industry.
Grind really meant a lot to Ryan.
Well, how about you then?
Yeah, so my answer is, so my first paid games gig, I believe, was a review for Paste Magazine, which is actually where a lot of
I remember that.
A lot of colleagues in games media got their start, because they were very good about like bringing on new writers and fresh voices and paying. I believe it was for, I want to say it was either a Dragon Age expansion or Cave Story. One of those two, I think, because I wrote those like around the same time, so I don't know which one was first, but like one of those is my answer.
So and then at some point along the way, you're doing work, you know, you're sort of building your career, you end up writing you end up with a byline actually every now and again in the New York Times. So do you pitch yourself for that? Do they come to you? Because either way, that's got to be an awesome, like, call your mom kind of moment, right?
Yeah, my dad framed the first thing I wrote for the New York Times. That's our local paper here in the city. I pitched, I think, my first Times piece. Well, so actually, we were doing some pieces. I had some pieces in the Times that didn't have my byline on them, because back in the day at Kotaku in like 2013 or something like that, we had some syndication deal with them where Kotaku reviews would be published abridged in the Times.
Right.
And they had a whole game review section, which they don't have anymore, sadly. But that was a thing for a while, although I don't think my name was on any of them because they removed the bylines for silly reasons. I'm sure they had their reasons. I'm sure they were like union reasons or something like that, but it was frustrating. My first Byline piece, I believe, was around 2017, because it was around the same time my first book came out, and I wanted to write an op-ed that was tied to it. And so I pitched it to them and got some bites, and that's how that happened. And then since then, I've like kept in touch with a couple of editors there and just written for them every once in a while. Now I can't really, because I'm writing for Bloomberg full time, and we're more competitors than Kotaku and the New York Times would be. So it wouldn't be quite as kosher for me to write for the Times these days. But yeah, that's always a super cool opportunity, and it's always super cool to see mainstream outlets kind of embracing the video game industry. It's been happening more and more, but that was always a very slow thing for some of these more widespread mainstream publications to really say, hey, this $180 billion video game industry, maybe we should cover that a little bit. Last year, actually, when the pandemic was first starting, the Times was interested in covering games, because games were obviously exploding when people were stuck at home. So they commissioned some articles, and I wrote a couple of pieces for them about Final Fantasy VII and about the pandemic in general and games. So, it was cool opportunities.
So how do you end up being or becoming like the investigative reporter guy? Like, is that an intentional thing where you just found like you just had a nose for it and an interest in that? Or did it sort of accidentally evolve into that?
Yeah, I don't really know. I mean, I think it's just that I'm kind of naturally a very persistent person, very curious, persistent person. And so when I ask questions, I mean, one of the coolest thing about being a reporter is if you have a question, you can try to find an answer to it and like help answer it for. And one of the things that I kind of wanted to take advantage of as I spent more time at Kotaku and had gotten into it for a year or so was just like taking that opportunity to be like, okay, in addition to the daily grind of blogging and writing about whatever news du jour is happening, I want to do longer form stuff and investigate stuff and trying to pursue pieces that like really meant something to me that I would remember. Like today I can sit here and if you show me Kotaku headlines from 2012 that I had written, I would have no idea that I'd written them. Like you could say to me, Jason, you wrote this story about the new Kingdom Hearts, and I would be like, no, I didn't. And you would show me and it would be my byline, and I would be like, oh my God, what? I don't remember that at all. But if you show me something that's like a longer form piece, something I spent a lot more time writing, then I would be like, oh yeah, that I did. I do remember that. I cared about that a lot. And I remember I started to, as this was happening, I was also talking to more and more people who worked in the video game industry as part of the job. You wind up going to E3 and GDC and stuff like that and meeting people and networking. And you hear a lot of stories, and you hear a lot of problems. And I think for a reporter, sometimes when you hear things, you're like, okay, I want to know more about that. I feel like this should be exposed. I feel like it would help people if this was exposed. But really, it's a curiosity thing. One of my first kind of big major pieces that really had impact and kind of reached a really broad audience and I guess it was very helpful for my career, because it really led to my first book, was a piece that I wrote in 2015 about the making of Destiny. And that piece had actually started a year earlier. It was like a year in the works. Not the entire time. It spent months not being worked on while key things happened and I waited for key sources. But a year earlier, Destiny had come out. And I think a lot of people were like, what the hell happened here? Like, what is this game? This game is such a mess. It's like this hodgepodge of scenes and sequences that make no sense, and characters popping in and out, and dialogue that is just totally meaningless and trite. And it was really, it just left a lot of questions. And I felt like I want to answer those questions for people. And I was finally able to do that in a piece that I published at the end of 2015 that was like about how Destiny was made, the original Destiny was made, and how it was all rewritten in the last year and kind of patchworked together. And just basically the story of what happened. And that story, I think, really helped lead me down the road of doing a lot of other stories that were similar. A, because other developers reached out and wanted to talk. B, because it gave me the kind of confidence in knowing, okay, I was able to tell this story that some people thought they would never get to hear, right. Unless like 10 years down the road, so, like Jason Jones talked to Ryan again and was like, I'm going to come down from my throne and give one of my every decade interviews to Ryan and tell the real story. Just having the confidence of being able to know, like, oh man, well, if I was able to tell that story, but there are a lot of stories that I could try to tell and reach out to people and try to get people to trust me enough to help them tell their story. And then the other thing that happened after that is that I heard from my now agent, Charlie Olson at Inkwell Management, who said, hey, you should write a book that's like stories like this. And I was like, that's a good idea. Do you think anyone would buy it? And that kind of sent me on the long road of publishing my first book, Blood, Sweat, and Pixels, which was this anthology of stories about how games are made. So that, that I think also really helped in terms of just like getting people to trust me to tell their stories and to be able to look at the articles and the book and the stories that I've written and just kind of know that I don't think I'm good at a ton of things, but I do think I'm good at getting people to trust that I will handle their story in a way that that treats them with respect, treats the story with respect, treats the material with respect, protects them, kind of satisfies people, I will not drop the ball. I will not publish something that is like a single source says this and is full of like half truths or whatever. Like in general, I think I have been able to convince people that I can handle their stories in a way that is worthy. And that to me is the most valuable thing as a reporter. And I'm forever grateful to people who trust me, who give me that trust and who trust me to tell their stories. That was kind of a long-winded answer to your question.
No, I love it. I'm curious. Yeah. Like when you start to kind of get into that and you start to find an interest in that and a nose for that, is it tough to sell your editor in chief, whether it's Stephen Totilo or even potentially people higher up on the ladder at Kotaku that, hey, I want to spend, again, not that you're spending every minute of every day for months on this stuff, but are those long form investigative things, the long term, I guess I should say, are those a tough sell at all when, you know, in this media market we both live and work in where it's all about, you know, how many pieces can you turn around in a day and get, you know, get as much traffic as possible?
Yeah, I mean, I think I've been very lucky in my career in that I've never been told not to pursue those things. I think Stephen very early on recognized that there was a lot of value to having Kotaku being known as this place that is like running these deep dives and investigations. Part of it is certainly that, like, at least for a while, at a certain point, I was doing less and less of like the daily news grind stuff. But I was often for a while, I was doing a lot of like daily posting and stuff like that. So and occasionally I would take off a day or two to work on a bigger story. But usually my reporting for bigger stories was kind of in the cracks of other blogging and other news reporting. It wasn't just like some of the work we were doing in Kotaku wasn't just long form pieces. We were also doing some shorter term and some short and medium length stories that were either new scoops about people, about games, about companies, or pieces that were maybe like 1200, 1500 words that were kind of meatier than your average blog post, but not quite like the big deep dive that everyone is hoping for about Anthem or whatever. I think at Kotaku we were able to do a healthy balance, and I was very fortunate in that I was never told like don't do this or don't do this. I was very lucky there, and same with Bloomberg, where I can, they give me even more autonomy and time, and I can just kind of pursue the stories that I'm interested in that I think are worth telling. It is worth noting that from like a metric point of view, the big stories also bring in good numbers. True. And like have a lot of impact. And two, even to, I don't know how much like managing upwards Steven was doing in the media ecosystem. And obviously Kotaku went through multiple owners. So we are editorial bosses and mandates, yeah, changed quite a bit over the years. But I do think, especially in the Nick Denton era, there was a lot of value placed on like writing stories that everyone was talking about, writing stories that people cared about, that were linked on other websites, that were aggregated and tweeted and trending on Twitter or whatever. And so I think that just brings a lot of value to a website and a brand, quote unquote, in a way that like the daily blogging traffic numbers might not. And then those stories will be big numbers. But yeah, I mean, I think that Gawker Media especially saw that with Stuffman's publishing of their story about Manti Te'o in 2013, where they revealed that this college football player's girlfriend didn't actually exist. And some of the other big impact stories that the company did over the years, I think kind of reflected. And I think other media organizations are thinking similarly, that like big high impact stories have a lot of value.
Absolutely.
At least I hope so. I think it's important to value things that go way beyond your kind of typical metrics, like your page views, right, and your whatever. Like, I think it's really important if you're, I don't know, a news outlet and you publish a story that's an investigation into a corrupt politician, and that story leads to the politician resigning. Like, all that is so much more important than any traffic numbers you could get, that like hopefully media outlets are recognizing the value of that stuff.
So do you have a favorite story that you've broken in your career? Is there one that stands out where it's just sort of top of the list for you?
Yeah, I mean, people ask me that sometimes, and I always say that my favorite stories are the dumb things that I wrote at Kotaku, like the silly, fun things, which people don't really understand, because I'm always like, yeah, sure, I enjoy publishing these big long form pieces, and I enjoy publishing impact things that maybe lead to changes at companies, and that is super rewarding and valuable for me and hopefully helps people. But I also just like writing really silly, dumb headlines and stories. And so like one of my favorite pieces that I've ever done, this is so stupid, but one of my favorite pieces I've ever done is just called Review Scores Ranked. And then it's a list of 10 review scores, and they're ranked in my order of however I chose to rank them. I think number one is 7, maybe number 10 is 2 or something like that. Go check it out. Review Scores Ranked. If you want the real Jason Schreier experience, go check
right.
out. Check
out. Well, I mean, it is the video game industry after all, right? Where it's an enthusiast media space. We're not, you know, even when you're, I mean, you're out there doing pretty serious work on a pretty regular basis, but it is still, we're here, we're writing about fun and games at the end of the day.
Yeah, I think that, but it's not just that. I also think that like satire can be a really useful tool. Another one of my favorite pieces, you're going to really like this one, is that in 2013, I remember this vividly, we were at PAX and BioShock Infinite was about to come out. Hey, maybe this will be a good segue to the book, but let
All
me
right,
tell
perfect.
The story first. BioShock Infinite was about to come out. And we had gotten a review copy, and then suddenly it's like the Friday of PAX or something like that, PAX East, and we see IGN publishes the exclusive review of BioShock Infinite, and it's like a great review.
Yeah, I wrote it,
and we're like, wait a minute, oh, you wrote it.
I
okay,
wrote
perfect.
It. Yeah,
so perfect. So we were like, wait a minute, we can't talk about a review. Turns out IGN has the exclusive, and like everyone else is embargoed for Monday, and IGN has this review that they can post on Friday. So we were like, what can we do? Why don't we post a review of IGN's review?
And
so
we I don't published. Remember that.
Oh man, you got to find it.
I will now. Yeah,
it's like it's not mean or anything. It's not taking right. shots at you. It's very silly, and like that was very intentional. We were like, we're not going to like insult IGN for doing this. Like, it's totally their prerogative to do this thing. So we're just going to do our review of IGN's review, and we're going to say we can't talk about BioShock Infinite. So we're just going to review IGN's review, and it was like our Kotaku review box that we used at the time, and it was like usually we would write time played or like length of the game. So we wrote like 3,000 words or something like that, and then it was like things we liked, and it was like, well, the page count was very good, and like the layout was excellent, and stuff like that. It's extremely silly, and we had so much fun putting it together and doing this kind of like cheeky shot at the idea of exclusive reviews. That was also just like in good fun, because it wasn't outwardly mean to anyone or anything like that. And stuff like that is like some of my most memorable stuff, because it's silly and it also proves a point. And don't get me wrong, like I said, I'm very much into publishing the high impact stories and the stories that are really gonna turn heads and get people talking and hopefully expose something or another that gets at a broader truth or gets at something interesting and important. But I also like the dumb shit. I think my last story at Kotaku, or one of my last stories at Kotaku, was Outer Worlds developer hires Outer Wilds writer or something like that. And that was also just extremely fun. I'm extremely glad that my two last stories at Kotaku were that, and then a story about how Rockstar has changed over the 18 months since we published our investigation into like their crunch culture and how they were, at least outwardly, at least for now, trying to get better in various ways. And so that dichotomy of those two things is just my favorite. That's what I loved about Kotaku, being able to do both of those things.
It's funny, like I think that was the last exclusive review IGN did. Because honestly, I mean, you remember, you've been
because
around
of
long
us,
enough.
Because of Kotaku's review.
It may very well be, but it just, it was such a thing for, particularly back in the magazine days, you know, where you wanted to be the mm-hmm. only magazine. Like if you're at the newsstand, you're going, well, all right, which magazine do I pick up? Oh, OXM's got the exclusive review of Halo 2. Well, I'm definitely going to pick that up because I want to know about that game. But yeah, it's just, you know, the media landscape changed and it just became, you know, it just didn't feel right anymore. Like it just didn't make sense to, you know, for almost just your credibility in a sense. Like, you know, you didn't want to, if you gave a game a good score, you didn't want it to be quite, you didn't want the validity of that to be questioned. So, but it's really fun. I'm totally going to look that up as soon as we're done recording.
Yeah, you got to find it. You got to find it after this.
As a podcast network, our first priority has always been audio and the stories we're able to share with you. But we also sell merch, and organizing that was made both possible and easy with Shopify. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell and grow at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. They have an all-in-one e-commerce platform and in-person POS system, so wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. With the internet's best converting checkout, 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms, Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers. Shopify has allowed us to share something tangible with the podcast community we've built here, selling our beanies, sweatshirts, and mugs to fans of our shows without taking up too much time from all the other work we do to bring you even more great content. And it's not just us. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the U.S. Shopify is also the global force behind Allbirds, Rothy's, and Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 175 countries. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/realm, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/REALM now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/realm.
Hey there, this is Justin Bartha. I made a funny new podcast, King of the Egg Cream. It has the greatest cast in the history of podcasts with actors like Louis Black.
I'm torn by my feelings for two women.
Bobby Cannavale.
You can eat it. Or if someone hits you, you can put it on your cut.
Melanie Lynskey.
I wonder what these marvelous things are that look just like boiled chicken feet.
Jason Ritter.
I can break things and pick locks and kill people.
Michael Stuhlbarg.
The whole point is to inspire people that they should make themselves better.
Ari Grainer.
No, don't whet its appetite. What are you, an idiot?
Me, Justin Bartha.
That's not just any egg cream, that's a Lemke's special.
And all narrated by the hilarious Richard Kind.
This is the story of Harry Dalowitz and how he rose from nothing to become New York's King of the Egg Cream.
So if you like funny true stories, come listen to King of the Egg Cream, available wherever you get your podcasts.
All right, the book. Yes, Press Reset, Ruin and Recovery in the Video Game Industry. How would you say that this book differs from your first one?
Yeah, so, okay, so I wrote my first book. My first book was essentially me asking the question, why are video games so hard to make? And answering that by looking at 10 different stories of games, games that were made, games that weren't made, games that were changed after launch, et cetera, and just kind of telling those stories. And then when I finished that, I had some other ideas. For a while, I was writing, oh, here's something that I haven't told anybody, really. I was writing my first like iteration of this book. I was like, I want to write a book about games as a service, the trend of games as a service in the video game industry. And just like examining that overall, maybe talking to like Fortnite. I talked to the people, to Brendan Green, who made PUBG, PlayerUnknown's Battlegrounds. I talked to a bunch of people at Riot Games to talk about like League of Legends. And I was kind of analyzing games as a service. At a certain point, I was just like, this is not really working for me, and just kind of scrapped that idea for a variety of reasons. But that was the original incarnation of this book. It's funny because this book has like, this book has been through such a saga that it almost feels like the development of a video game. And I'll get into another thing that happened in a sec. But so at that point, I actually, the impetus for this was like, all right, well, the video game industry, if I'm looking at like the video game industry as a whole, one thing I keep hearing from people is about brain drain and about how the industry has so much trouble keeping people around. And I wanted to know why that was. I wanted to know why it felt like this video game industry just can't make a sustainable career for its workers, And like, it's so rich. There's so much money in this industry, but workers are not seeing any of that. It's like going to the executives and workers are just getting laid off all the time. Their studios are shutting down all the time. So I decided I'm going to look at a bunch of case studies, stories of game studios shutting down and kind of trace the paths of people who were there. And there were two kind of things that I knew. Well, there was one thing I really wanted to do a little bit differently, maybe a little bit better than I did in the first book, and that is follow the human stories as opposed to just the stories of a game. And I wanted, with the first book, I think a lot of people told me that their favorite chapter was the one about Stardew Valley and the kind of solo developer Eric Barone and his journey in, through the trials and tribulations of making that game. And it's a great story, obviously, but I think one of the reasons people connected to that so much is because it was about one person, as opposed to a lot of the other stories in that book, which are about a bunch of people making a game, and you might not remember all of the names when you leave the book, other than like Eric Barone or like Neil Druckmann or someone who you might have known coming into the book. But like, you're not really leaving Blood, Sweat, and Pixels with a lot of names in your head. And I wanted people to come into my next book and leave it thinking like knowing some people, knowing a few people in the games industry, and not necessarily the most famous people, but like a few people who just have these fascinating careers and paths and journeys. So I decided, okay, I'm going to pick a few studios and trace their what happened to them and talk to people who were there, figure out how they shut down, why they shut down, what happened there. And then, and this is a really important part, figure out what happened to people after that. And the reason it's called Ruin and Recovery in the video game industry is because the book is very much about both the ruin and the recovery. Yeah. It's about the studios shutting down for reasons, for all sorts of reasons. And then it's about the people who were involved. What happened to them? How were they impacted? What do they decide to go and do next? And then from a bigger picture standpoint, I wanted to look at why is the video game industry broken in such a way where people cannot seem to have sustainable careers without moving all over the world or losing their jobs every few years? And how can that be fixed? Is there a way that can be fixed? And yeah, the results of that whole saga are in this book. And I think if you come into this book expecting it to be Blood, Sweat, and Pixels, that's not what you're going to get. I think you'll get the same like level of writing and reporting. The reporting is all based on interviews that I conducted, so it's all entirely firsthand reporting. But the stories are very different, and I think better than my first book. I think a lot more human and a lot, I think, easier to connect to, and I think will resonate with a lot of people in a stronger way even than the Blood, Sweat, and Pixels stories did.
Well, we're going to get into some of the specific stories in a second, but it's funny, just piggybacking off of what you just said, I'll be totally honest with you, and I don't mean this disrespectfully at all, but my big takeaway from the book is that I don't think I ever want to work in video game development, because the stories that are told here are they're heart-wrenching, they're difficult. I mean, you just hit on some of the high-level things, but when you've come away from this book and you finish writing it, is that your takeaway too? What do you take away from this book, and what are you hoping that that readers are going to take away from it?
That was my takeaway like 10 years ago when I started reporting on this industry. It's really not an industry that treats people well. So when I read Blood, Sweat, and Pixels, I would say, like, anecdotally, about 50% of responses that I get are like, oh my God, now I want to work in games. And 50% are like, oh my God, after reading this, I would never work in games. I knew when I published Press Reset that that number would look a lot different. I think most of the people who read this will say, wow, I would never want to work in the video game industry. And that's for very good reason. I mean, I think that this book, I actually just wrote the copy of the book you saw is an early copy and doesn't have the end, like, acknowledgments section. At the end of the acknowledgments section, I wrote a little message about my daughter. And I was like, I hope, who's 18 months old, she's way too small to read this book. And I wrote, I hope that by the time you are old enough to read this book, it is less of like a chronicle of how things are and more a chronicle of how things used to be.
Yeah.
Because that is very much my hope here, is that I hope, like, first and foremost, I hope people who read this are entertained and informed and come away with it from the book feeling like they learned something and enjoyed the read and just came away from it feeling like they know more. That's goal number one. But kind of a sub goal to that, maybe a goal number two, maybe
side
a goal
quest,
1B,
if you will.
Yeah, exactly. Is that I hope that this leads to some change, because this is an industry that desperately needs to change. It's funny, when I sent this out, I got some kind of early feedback, beta testing, if you will. The book industry actually calls it beta readers. I sent it out to some beta readers from feedback, and some of them were colleagues, friends, and then some of them were game developers. And the game developers were all just like, oh my God, this was miserable to read. Like, is this really the industry we work in? God. And my hope is that, like, more and more people will read this and look around and be like, wow, this, we can't keep letting this happen. I think there's kind of one of the points that I wanted to make, and I'll be repeating this several times, I'm sure, is that I think that people kind of have associated my work, especially in recent years, with crunch culture and the overwork that is so ubiquitous in the video game industry. And while I think that's a problem, don't get me wrong, and it's something that I'm plan to keep writing about it and have written about, I think the thing that really drives people away from games is the volatility. And that is really what this book is about, volatility in the video game industry. The fact that, like, to have a career in games, you might have to move cities every 3 years, change jobs every 2 years. Like, it's just not sustainable. And it's when we see things like even just a couple of weeks ago, Activision Blizzard, like, laying hundreds of people off while giving its CEO more millions of dollars, it is just like, how can this continue? And I really hope that this is a call to action, and that this book is just ultimately one of the much needed steps on the road, even if it just plays a small part. Like, I don't expect this book to change the whole video game industry or anything like that. But if even one executive reads this book and is like, wow, we have to do things differently here, then I will be very happy and gratified. And hopefully.
So
we'll see what happens.
The book covers, like you mentioned, there's big studios, small studios in this. There's Kurt Schilling's 38 studios. There's their sister studio, Big Huge Games. Mythic is in here. 2K Marin, you mentioned Irrational with Bioshock, among others. Do you have a favorite when you started digging in, like that just really captured your attention the most, or maybe surprised you the most of where that story took you?
I don't have a favorite, because they were all pretty, they all took me in unexpected directions, actually. Like, believe it or not, like, every single story in this book surprised me in some way or another. Even the ones that I thought I knew, like Irrational, took me into some directions that I didn't think it was going to. And just hearing about some of the people's stories after what happened there. The story actually that I first knew that I was going to put in this book no matter what was 38 Studios, because I was like, that is such a spectacular implosion. And that story is so remarkable. And also I didn't know the whole story before I started writing the book, but I knew that, like, obviously 38 had this game, Kingdoms of Amalur, that was actually just re-released.
THQ now.
Consoles. Yeah. I was just playing it on my Switch. But people associate that with 38 Studios and say, like, oh, at least Kurt Schilling's studio made this game. But most people don't realize that it was actually made by a totally different studio that 38 Studios just happened to buy, that was down in Maryland. And the story of what happened to them, I think, is going to be the most shocking to people, like, because most people don't know what happened to them. And I'll kind of leave the details for people to discover in the book. Yeah. But, like, the way in which Big Huge Games was kind of saved from death and then put to death in a very short period of time is just remarkable and wild. And yeah, it's a pretty insane story. But really, I mean, like things I learned about Mythic were fascinating. I didn't know a lot about that studio when I started writing that story, and the Enter the Gungeon folks, who are really interesting. 2K Marin, just a lot of interesting details about that. And yeah, following Warren Spector's story at the beginning of the book was also really fascinating to me, and hearing about his screaming matches towards the end of his studio was another fascinating thing. So yeah, I can't pick a favorite. They're all my babies, all of these stories.
Well, you mentioned Mythic. I mean, EA, as you well know, deservedly or not, has one of the industry's worst reputations among gamers. I mean, do you get the sense that the developers that you've spoken to for the book over the years feel as negatively about EA as gamers seem to? Because, like, you know, the Mythic story, which, again, I'm not going to give away the whole thing, but, you know, they closed down Mythic, but you mentioned in the book that the developers you spoke to, you know, they were, you know, they didn't really blame it on EA. So I'm sort of curious, just with them specifically and talking to developers, how the sense that you get of how developers feel about EA.
Yeah, EA is actually known within the video game industry as a company that treats its workers pretty well, all things considered. And yes, the Mythic shutdown was handled, I think, pretty humanely. But it's still a company where the CEO is making $30 million a year and clocking in 9 to 5 every day. So it's not, I mean, ultimately, we're talking about, like, a capitalistic system that is just damaging and leeching and really harmful to people. But yeah, that said, I mean, EA is definitely the company that, like, has the most disproportionate, like, internet anger to how it actually treats people. And I think a lot has changed for EA over the years. But they're still, like, a corporation. They're still going to be laying people off. They're still going to be just kind of moving numbers around and prioritizing cost cutting and risk aversion over like people's creativity and stuff like that. So I mean, you see their games output, like, their games output is what it is, and people can judge the pros and cons of, like, getting Madden and Battlefield every year, but like, this is not a company that is going off and saying, here, game developers, go and be creative for the next few years. So yeah, it's like any of these big companies, it has many of its pros and cons, but there aren't a ton of people who are like, man, EA is a sweatshop these days. Like, I don't get that sense. Although it's going to depend which studio you're at within EA, since EA is such a big publisher and culture, like, different companies within EA have their own cultures. But I do think, as a kind of in a better sense, yes, EA has tried to do the right thing by people. The problem is that maybe it hasn't tried enough. It's tried to the point where, like, they'll give decent severance packages to people they lay off, but not to the point where they'll cut the CEO's salary by $20 million in order to keep Visceral Games around or something like that.
Right. So I know we're recording this before the book's officially out for total public consumption, but have you heard yet from anybody who's not portrayed or who doesn't come across well in the book? Because there are definitely a few of those people. I also, on that note, I kind of thought it was a bit telling that some of the people who don't look very good in this book have a little footnote next to their name at the bottom of the page that you note that you contacted them for comment in the book, but they chose not to comment.
Yes. No, I haven't. I don't know if I'll hear from them. I doubt it. I think I know who you're specifically talking about there. I actually tried really hard to get Kurt Schilling on the record, and he had actually agreed to talk to me, but then just kind of stopped responding, unfortunately. Basically ghosted me for a while and was not able to get in touch with him, unfortunately, because I find him super complicated and interesting as a character, since he's this guy who is like a maniac on the internet who's like getting fired for posting transphobic memes and racism and stuff like that. But at the same time, he's a guy who was, I think, beloved by a lot of people who felt like he was a great leader for them. And there was something really fascinating about that story and about him as a character. And I would have loved to hear his take, but unfortunately that did not work out. And yeah, I mean, I'm looking forward to seeing how people react to the book. I will say that there's definitely, I mean, this book, like many books, had to go through legal review, and there were a couple of things that our lawyers here of my publisher asked me to take out regarding a certain person who you were probably thinking of, and I guess I'll just leave it at that. What you're seeing is the lawyer sanitized version.
Right. Well, inevitably, right? It's your publisher doesn't want to get sued, so
they do not. They do not. And I think that lawyers are they don't want to take any risks, even if something can be backed up pretty well. But they're not quite. I think book lawyers are not quite on the same level as I guess it depends. I shouldn't generalize, but yeah, my lawyer was a little bit on the risk averse side.
On that note, I'm curious, are you, just from not just the book, but over the years, are you persona non grata to any major developers or publishers out there because of previous reports you've done? Because, you know, I could certainly understand that based on a lot of the things I've read from you, but I'm kind of curious of your perspective on that.
Yeah, it's funny. I've written a lot about a lot of different companies, and a lot of things that talked about people's workplaces, and I think exposed some things that didn't want exposed. But the only company that has like really blacklisted me to the point where they've never responded to me in 8 years is Bethesda and your boy Pete Hines, who you mentioned earlier. Yeah. And what's funny about that is that it was in response to me reporting. Well, it was. It's a few different things on the same year. Basically reporting on the development of the new Doom and how that was going through development hell back in 2013. Then reporting on the new Prey and how Pete Hines lied to the press and said Arkane isn't doing Prey. And then we said, actually, Arkane is doing Prey. And then reporting on Fallout 4 and how it existed and was set in Boston. And since then, like, Bethesda is the only company that is just like such a, like their PR team is so run by babies that they just would never talk to me again after that, or Kotaku. They just completely blacklisted it after that. So to this day, I think that like a lot of PR people don't enjoy the things I publish, which makes sense. I mean, that's going to happen.
It's not part of their plan, right?
Right. But they are still like willing to talk to me because they recognize truly and fairly that talking to me is better than not talking to me, and at least trying to provide their own context is going to help in the long run. So like even like, I don't know, CD Projekt or Rockstar or EA or Sony, or like all these companies that I've written negative things about or exposés about are still willing to talk to me, even if they're not like lining up to invite me to their events.
Right.
And like that.
Right.
Bethesda to this day is the only company that just like will never talk to me.
So that has followed you from, that's not just a Kotaku thing. That's a Kotaku and Trier thing.
Well, I don't know. I mean, at Bloomberg, it's different. And if we needed to reach out to Bethesda, I would have one of our other 2,000 reporters reach out to them at this point, just because it's not worth me even trying. But yeah, I'm pretty sure it's personal with the people who run Bethesda's PR. I don't know if Microsoft buying them is going to change.
Yeah, I was just going to ask.
I doubt it.
Maybe there's a hatchet that can be buried there. Who knows? But
I doubt it. But the thing is, well, so they know at this point that like they don't have to deal with me if they want to do Bloomberg stuff. Like there are a bazillion other people here for them to talk to and work with. So yeah, they as far as I know, I am still blacklisted. I have not emailed Pete Hines recently to check if he'll respond to me. But as far as I know.
So, all right, let's shift gears here. You've been beating the unionization drum for many years, and that's certainly a big part of the book as well. I mean, you clearly believe very strongly in it, though, even though you're not a game developer yourself, this is your observation of what you see in the industry of something that could fix it. I mean, to your credit as well, you don't sort of just hammer that in the book. You do present multiple developer perspectives on, both sides of unionization in the book. What do you think, in your opinion, is it going to take for real for the game industry to unionize? Is it going to be like a major studio leading the charge, like a Rockstar or a Bungie or something like that?
It could be. I mean, what we're seeing at Amazon in the tech industry is really interesting, and we'll see how that vote goes in Alabama, and if that kind of leads to some dominoes tipping over in the tech world, and if that also leads to dominoes tipping in the video game world. I think that it's a super complicated subject. So first of all, to address how it's handled in the book actually, it doesn't talk about unionization until the final chapter, right, which is like very deliberately exploring solutions to all the problems that all the previous chapters are presenting. So it's very much like 8 chapters telling stories, talking about what's going on in this industry, and then a final chapter that is like, hey, let's look at a bunch of different ways to solve this. Yeah. And I do think unionization is and kind of has to be one of those ways, because it's the only way for workers to get a seat at the table. And one of the things that I found is whenever you talk to someone who is anti-union for whatever reason, they might have their own reasons and their points for not liking the idea of unions. But when you ask them, okay, then how do you solve these problems that the video game industry faces? They never really have an answer. And sometimes that's because they're comfortable, and so they don't really see these problems, right, as problems. And that's a problem. That itself is a problem. That's like a thing that that's one of the obstacles that people are going to have to overcome, is getting the more comfortable people to kind of accept that, like, everyone needs to be elevated, not just the people who are making good salaries and have stable positions or executives or whatever. So yeah, I mean, to the larger point about what it will take, I think that, like, it could be a smaller game studio doing it. It could be one big game studio doing it. It could be like a studio that is known for having specific issues that unionizes to try to combat those issues, like a Riot Games, yeah, or a Naughty Dog or a Blizzard or something like that. But from a logistical and practical perspective, it's really tough. A lot of these companies are anti-union for obvious reasons. They think it'll cost them a lot of money if workers unionize. They don't want to have to deal with unions and collective bargaining agreements and workers getting a seat at the table. So there are a lot of obstacles. There's also very much a kind of libertarian "fuck you, got mine" attitude among certain game developers, among a lot of people who come to this from this perspective of like, hey, I'm really good at my job and I'm doing well for it, so why do I need to help everybody else? Which, I mean, I understand, but I think at a certain point you just have to look around and say, like, man, if the people who are lower than me, who are around me, just like are suffering this much, maybe we need to find a way to elevate them too, and maybe some of these systemic issues can only really be battled with systemic action. So yeah, I mean, I do think it's inevitable. I think it's going to happen. I just think that, like, the only questions are when and where and in what form and how's it going to start and what's it going to look like. But it's hard to imagine that not happening, given the climate of the video game industry and the fact that so much money in the video game industry is like going straight up to the top and yeah, not trickling down at all. Is just one of those things that should be like a giant incentive for everybody to get together and say, hey, what are we going to do about this?
Well, I mean, I appreciate that you are optimistic that it's inevitable, but let's look at it. What do you see as the worst case scenario for the industry if it does not change its ways?
I don't know. It's hard to say. Like, I don't think video games are going away or anything, but like, in a lot of ways, we are in the worst case scenario already, because there are so many people who have just been burnt out, and like, who knows how much talent has been lost, how much brain drain there's been at some of these companies. So I talk to a lot of people who work in the video game industry and just hear a lot of anecdotes and hear a lot of perspectives on various studios and stories and stuff. And one of the things that I hear pretty constantly is how hard it is to find senior developers. And alongside that, one of the things that I also hear is how frequent it is for a game company to make the same mistake over and over again. And I think one of the reasons for that, the main reason for that, is brain drain and people just burning out. And that's not something that is really measured or can really be like codified and printed in an article somewhere. There isn't any statistic for like X percent of people left the video game industry last year or anything like that. So it's tough to point at something and be like, well, look at this problem here. Instead, you just kind of have to look around anecdotally and try to figure out why everybody at this game studio is in their 20s and all the people who started in the 90s are gone. But look, here's a perfect example of something like that, which is at many game companies, there's a tendency to look at chapter two of this book is about BioShock Infinite. And it's about very much the philosophy that Irrational had, which was like, we'll spend a few years messing around and changing everything and like seeing what we can come up with and in fantasy land and not crunching and just coming in and being in fun idea land for a while. Yeah. And then suddenly like the rubber hits the road and you're like, oh man, we have 2 years left and we have to ship a game and we don't have anything. And you go into intense crunch mode for the next 2 years. And then when the game ships, you're like, man, we really got to do better next time. But you know what? Let's take it easy for now. And then a bunch of people who went through that leave, a bunch of new people come in and everyone else is like, we're not crunching. We're in fantasy land for the next 3 years and let's hang out for a while. And then 3 years from then, everyone's like, wait a minute, what just happened here? We got to ship a game. And the cycle continues on and on and on. And I think that, like, I bet there are AAA game developers listening to this right now and just like nodding their heads furiously and going, oh my God, like, why is this still happening? And it's just like, there's a belief, I think, among the video game industry that like, this is how you make games. Like you have to just iterate. You have to fuck around for a while until you figure out what the game is. And maybe to some extent that's true, but like, there are so many of these patterns we keep seeing repeat themselves over and over again. And it's hard to say that that's sustainable. Like, really, to answer your original question, I think we are kind of in the worst case scenario, and that's continuing. And from a player's perspective, we're seeing a lot of that. You're seeing games that are super buggy and games that are shipping unfinished and games that are having... look at Cyberpunk. Sure. A lot of the issues I'm talking about can definitely be applied to Cyberpunk. A lot of the issues that I explore in this book can definitely be applied to Cyberpunk. And so like, from a game quality perspective, it's not good. From a human perspective, it's really not good. And I just don't see how things can get better without some sort of widespread systemic change in how games are made and how game companies operate.
Well, I feel like if there's one company that comes out of your book looking pretty good, pardon me, it's Devolver. What are some other examples that you've encountered over the years of studios that are treating their employees well? Like, are there a few good examples out there of like, no, this is a good model for what it can be?
Yeah, I don't know. I hate to say things like that. Well, so Devolver, to give you a little more context, Devolver is a publisher that that the Enter the Gungeon people went to after leaving Mythic, and they got a pretty good deal there. Devolver, I think, is I don't know how they treat their internal people, but as a publisher, they're pretty well respected and appreciated by developers who work with them, which is a little bit different than them being employers.
True.
They're kind of contracting the developers. But I hate answering that question, because sometimes I'll give an answer and then based on like what I've heard from a few people, and then I'll hear from someone else who's like, actually this place sucked for various reasons. So it's tough to really answer that question, especially because so many of these cultures are so humongous that it's like, it depends. Like some people, a bunch of people at Studio X might have had an amazing experience there, but because they were on the QA team, and well, not the QA team, nobody in QA is an amazing experience. Those people were on the design team and they had a great boss. Whereas these people on the art team had a terrible boss who just abused them constantly and would scream in meetings and was asking them all to work on Saturdays no matter what, and so on and so on. And so it can be tough to like really assess a company without me actually going in there and talking to as many people as possible to figure out like what's what. It's tough to prove a negative. It's impossible to prove that a company isn't mistreating people.
So
I can't answer that question, unfortunately, as much as I would like to.
Well, how about this isn't a story from the book, but you had previously, one of your big reports in the last couple of years was about BioWare and the toxic work culture there in the lead up to Anthem's release. That was pretty damning for management there. I mean, have you been able to sort of keep in touch with people and follow up on that at all? And maybe have you gotten any sense from any sources that things are any better at BioWare?
I don't know. This is not something that I've spent a bunch of time looking into just yet. I find that it's tough to really know until you're towards the end of a game's life cycle how well they're treating its people. And that's one of the reasons I was hesitant actually to talk about, to really dive into Rockstar as the one of the last Kotaku stories I mentioned, because their game was still far away and is still far away. And so it was hard to know like what's the last year of development going to look like. And I feel kind of similarly with the BioWare stuff, especially because their game is still like their new dragon, the next Dragon Age is still like up in the air in so many ways. And still, they're still trying to answer so many questions that I think it's tough to be like, well, are things as stressful now as they were on Anthem? Because they might still be early on. But I don't know. I mean, I don't tend to write too much about studios. There are exceptions. I don't want to give like general rules, because I will write about games that are currently in development. And I plan to about some games, but in the near future. But I do think that like there's some merit to waiting until a game is out and has been through everything before talking about it, because you don't really have the full picture until then. Just as an example, when I published that Anthem article, I actually got a bunch of messages from people from other game developers who are like, hey, you could plug in my game's name for Anthem in this story and it would be the exact same story. Two of those games included The Last of Us 2 and Cyberpunk. I think that writing about Cyberpunk as an example was not super, I don't think it would have had a lot of value to write about Cyberpunk and the culture behind that game and the making of that game in 2019, when it was a year and a half from being released. I made a judgment call there, and I just didn't think I put it all aside until after the game came out before I would really dive into it a little bit more. But yeah, in general, I think, and again, I hate giving these broad descriptions because people will find games that I've written about where they were in development when I published X story about them or whatever. But as a general rule, not to be applied in every single case, but as a general rule, I think that I find it more useful and more valuable for people to just wait until the game comes out and we can tell the whole story from beginning to end.
Well, you mentioned CD Projekt Red and Cyberpunk, and that story is incredible of what we even know publicly. I mean, it seems like it might be worse than the worst case scenario for as far as how Cyberpunk has been received and how it's done. And do you feel like, based on, you know, just kind of your sense of it and reporting on the industry over the years, is the entire long-term plan for Cyberpunk out the window? Like, is the reputation of that studio and of that franchise salvageable?
Yeah, it's definitely salvageable. And I think we all tend to have short-term memories, and like, well, I think in a few months we're not going to forget about this. But like, if CD Projekt Red comes out with this amazing expansion that is like focused and solves some of the problems that Cyberpunk had, and if they release it for free and like find some other and publish some more stuff that is like, dear gamers, we love you, I think they can win back the trust of fans. Hopefully, fans and gamers out there, hopefully everybody takes a lesson from this, which which is not to trust in put any trust in brands and to focus more on people. But what can you do? It's always going to be the case in this industry where when 400 people make a game, it's hard to know exactly who's who. It's easier to remember like, oh, CD Projekt Red, I love them. But at least people can avoid pre-ordering games as opposed to books, which you should pre-order. You should definitely pre-order Press Reset because it's finished. Look, it's in the background. It's done. It's not buggy. I promise. Right, it's not going to be. It's not going to be full of issues. But yeah, I do think they can salvage this. Obviously, it sucks, and it sucks for a lot of the people there. And I think they're losing people who don't want to have to crunch and don't like the culture there and aren't happy there for whatever reason. But that plays into what I was talking about earlier. That's an overall systemic problem, not just the CD Projekt people, right. Not just the CD Projekt problem. But yeah, I do think that it can be salvaged. It might just take a while, and hopefully it teaches a lot of lessons to everybody and leads to management actually listening when developers say, hey, this is not enough time to finish this game. And yeah, hopefully good things come of it. But yeah, certainly a sucky situation for a lot of people.
Well, I really enjoyed the book, Jason. It's Press Reset, Ruin and Recovery in the Video Game Industry. If you've ever wanted to know some behind the scenes, again, as Jason says, the human stories. I mean, that resonates with me a lot because that's my goal with this show is to try and get to those human stories behind some of these developers. And the book does a great job of that with all those studios that we talked about. It is out May. What is the date, Jason?
May 11th.
May 11th.
And yeah, people who pre-order it can actually get, we're doing a whole pre-order bonus. It's very Video Game Industry. people who pre-order the book can get the first chapter and the prologue sent to them early. They can read it early.
A readable demo, free readable
go
demo.
And pre-order it. Yeah, you get a demo. Go and pre-order the book and you go to the portal website, the Grand Central Publishing website for the book, and you should be able to fill out a form and you'll get the first chapter.
So that's fantastic. Cool. Jason Schreier, thank you so much for joining me.
Thanks, Ryan. It's a pleasure.
All right. For more from the best, brightest, most interesting minds across the entire games industry, media development, or otherwise, stay tuned every month for a new episode of IGN Unfiltered.
Anna Sheridan, New York Times bestselling author of Supernatural Horror. Missing for nearly 6 months now.
That's not possible. Is the compass broken? Or did I turn to the sleep pattern?
Given the circumstances of her disappearance, someone with a more vivid imagination might decide she'd pierced the veil, so to speak.
Weak radio signal. 700 meters. Closing fast.
There's no place for ghost stories and close encounters in this investigation, or any other.
I need you. Find me.
To save yourself.
Of course.
What else would it be?
The Sheridan Tapes, a serialized horror mystery podcast. Stream the complete series today on Realm and on all podcasting platforms.